I am dumbfounded.
Wow.
For people listening, I have not heard that. I did not know that was coming. Like, I just mind blowing.
Are you totally overwhelmed with navigating your music career by yourself? Then you've come to the right place. My name is Shay Leonia, and I'm a professional singer, recording artist, and music career strategist. On this show, I share my expertise from the last 20 years in the music industry, along with some tips that I give my clients every single day. You'll also get to hear from some pretty badass guests. Get ready for some chutzpah and a lot of oversharing. It's time for the Millennial Musician Podcast. Welcome back to the Millennial Musician Podcast. I got to tell you, I really struggled with coming up with the title for today's episode, not because I wasn't out of ideas, but just because there were too many. We touched on so much, and I'm talking about my guest, Sean Sataro, who is a legend in hip-hop journalism. It was funny because I just got so fed up that I went over to ChatGPT, and I said, hey, ChatGPT, I call him Chat for short. I said, Chat, would you mind if I give you all of the things that Sean and I discussed and you spit out a few ideas on what I could talk about? And once I submitted all we discussed to Chat, he said, hey, you talked about a lot with Sean. I'm not even kidding. That's exactly what ChatGPT said to me, was that we talked about a lot. No shit. I initially brought him on to talk about how artists like you and me can get into publications like Complex Magazine. But I just, you know, aptly titled now with the integrity component in the title, it just didn't feel right to title the episode that because it was just such a small fraction of our conversation. We do go into detail on a lot of other important things and relevant things. So I think that you're still going to really enjoy this episode. What I will say is that there is a portion where Sean allowed me to go vulnerable with him. And we do talk about some sensitive topics. When that conversation begins, you're going to hear this sound. And once it finishes, you're going to hear the sound again. And that's just so that you can feel free to skip over it if you're just not in the mood to go there while you're listening today. But if you do get a chance and you are able to revisit it at some point, I do encourage you to because it was a really important part of the conversation. I had so much fun gathering and wrangling Sean's adoring fans together. People that either know him through his work or know him in real life. Everyone had just raving reviews for him. I don't want to hold you up any longer. Please enjoy this conversation with Sean Sataro. Everyone, thank you so much for tuning into the Millennial Musician Podcast. I am here today with none other than Sean Sataro. I'm kind of nervous. It's so funny. I've been such an admirer of yours, and it's just really magical that you're here right now. So thank you for making the time.
Thanks for having me, Shay. I really appreciate it. I'm really happy to be here. You know, I haven't been a musician for many years, so I'm curious to see where this conversation goes.
We're going to stay right in your lanes. You have many of them to stay in, so it should be easy. But I just wanted to say that as we're recording this, it's April 17th, and yesterday was actually Kool Herc's birthday, which I think is very fitting to have you on today of all days. One of my favorite hip-hop memories was of him actually grabbing some paper towels at SOBs to wipe off the stage when Organized Confusion had reunited. So I would just love to kick this off by hearing what's one of your favorite hip hop memories.
It's funny you say that. And there are so many that I wouldn't even know where to start. So I'll just piggyback off what you said, which is, I don't know if you remember Mobile Mondays.
Over. Yeah.
Yeah. So you remember Mobile Mondays.
There.
Yeah. So for listeners, this was probably still is a weekly night they have at Bowery Electric where they spin only 45s. And I went very regularly for a long time. And everyone, Jess Blaze would constantly be there, a young guru, all kinds of people there. I went there one time. I don't know if the weather was bad or if I was there early or what it was, but there were not a ton of people there. But three of the people there were, I kid you not, Pharoah Monch, Kool Herc, and Vernon Reid.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah, Monch is just always going to be a mishmash of just legends around that man. He's just so good for that.
He's a great, obviously one of the top rappers. And I've been fortunate enough to interview him a bunch of times. And his former business partner is a close friend. So I've met him a number of times over the years and nothing but incredibly positive things to say about him.
Yeah, 5 stars from this end as well. So clearly we're on a musician podcast. You have a background as a musician. You went to Berkeley?
Yeah, I grew up playing guitar, a little bit of electric bass, and yeah, went to Berkeley. And obviously that's, at least when I was there, was primarily a jazz school. And I love jazz, but not with the passion enough to make it a profession. I always played in rock bands and stuff for a long time and did a number of things over the years, I think most of which your listeners would definitely not have heard of. I would say probably the highlights musician-wise were I was on one of the tiny stages of the Warped Tour many years ago.
Wow.
And occasionally on the main stage, but mostly on one of the tertiary or whatever comes after tertiary stages.
Still counts.
But that was a great summer. And I was lucky enough to play on the Dresden Dolls' first album, and they are still going strong.
Wow. Were you playing guitar by then or still dabbling in both? Or
that was... On that record, I played actually guitar and bass both because they were first starting out and they needed a friend who would play for free.
Yep. Okay. So then as a bassist, what's your favorite hip hop bass line and why is it Cool Like That by Diggable Planet?
Look, that is obviously amazing. I will say that New York State of Mind was always one that, you know, would come up in rehearsal spaces and things occasionally as well. So that is also up there.
Okay, very cool. That's a surprising answer. So you're obviously very well known for your journalism and for your book. You've authored an incredible book, which we are going to talk about. But you also ran for years with a podcast called The Cypher, which is now just this like gold mine of information for hip hop enthusiasts and just general music lovers alike. One of the things that I really admire about your interviewing style on The Cypher was that no matter how someone's temperament started off, they would always end up being so delighted and excited by how vast your knowledge is. And so I want to play a clip for everyone.
Oh, we'll see where this goes.
Check 1, 2. This is Jay Smooth.
This is Mecca Brashawn.
This is Tembisa.
AK.
This is Tony Blackman.
This is Man Manny Faces.
This is Mila.
Mr. Lynn here.
John.
Sean Sitaro.
Sean Sitaro.
Mr. Sean Sitaro.
The music industry was not always the most friendly place, particularly not for a woman or a black woman. But Sean showed up.
Dope editor, dope writer, journalist, all of that, man. Just a dope contributor to the culture.
Too many of our dope music journalists go unacknowledged. And these cats are keepers of the culture, teachers of the history.
And he gets the goods. You got to check out The Cypher because it's a lot of good work that was done over there. Shout out to Great Gate.
An accomplished musician. I don't know how many people know that. And a good friend in real life.
An amazing interviewer. Someone who contributes to the culture by documenting it with great insight and care.
I know it's difficult to be a journalist in today's world, especially an entertainment journalist. But I've always appreciated Sean's work. I'm going beyond the surface.
The second he gets behind the pen and those glasses come off, he is a Tekashi killing Superman.
I really love his respect for the culture. So many people just use this thing as a job, and for Sean, you can tell it's an actual passion.
I'm really grateful to count him among the people who I was able to look to as a mentor in this industry.
I want to let the world know Sean Sitaro is a real one.
Give this man his flowers, y'all.
Love you, Sean.
We appreciate you. One love.
Shout out to you, Sean Sitaro, because you are super dope.
Yo, one time for the boy, Sean. I'm staying on this good side.
Respect to my man, Sean Sitaro.
I am dumbfounded. So when you started playing that, I assumed that this was a bumper for your show and the blurb, whatever the clip from the show is going to come later. Wow. For people listening, I have not heard that. I did not know that was coming. Those were presumably all original interviews done between when I was booked and today. Thank you. That's incredible. And I definitely need my own copy of that to even fully digest that it happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many amazing people. And I'm blown away by what they said. Thank you for putting that together.
Of course. Yeah. And anybody listening, I will be sure to put the full length versions of those clips at the end of this episode. Of course, Sean, you're going to get all of that as well. But I just wanted you to know you've really made an incredible impact, and everyone sings your praises from whether it was The Cypher or your journalism. So just thank you for all you've done. And yeah, and let's get back to it. So Chuck D recently said that he considers himself to have somewhat of dyslexia when it comes to memorizing even his own lyrics. And I can't even remember why I walked in the kitchen. I would just love to know how you keep it all straight, because as I was alluding to before, so many people get so excited by the end of the interviews. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that you're able to cite certain bars that they have or progressions of their albums over their career. How do you keep it all straight?
To hone in on the cipher specifically, right? It was just a matter of preparing for each episode as much as I possibly could with as much time as was allowed, depending on scheduling. I was often researching up until I absolutely had to write down and then subsequently pare down and order questions up until the night before. There was no limit to other than the date of the interview for the amount of research I put in. It wasn't like I went into every interview knowing everything about everyone's catalog before I even reached out to them, right? A lot of times I had a knowledge of the guest, but it was in leading up to the interview that I would go deep into whatever they had done, their music or accomplishments or whatever. And I would start out with the goal of trying to get through everything with not always accomplished. I remember preparing for Slim Thug, and that man just has hundreds and hundreds of hours of recorded music. And then that's even before you get to all the slowed down stuff and all of the remixes and all of the other things. Mm-hmm. Like there, for some of the people, there's no way to get through everything, but I really tried to be completist. Now, whether that was good journalism or tending to my anxiety, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yeah. But even like people like Salaam Remy would send you down these massive rabbit holes and you were just mm-hmm. nailing every single reference. And I know that obviously in post-production, there are clips added in that might provide some footnotes for people listening, but you knew right away every single person that he's going to reference. What's one of the things that really surprised you that you learned during one of these interviews? Because I'm thinking I recently did an interview with Booty Brown and I had no idea that Imani was in the Remember the Time music video. So Is there anything like that really shocked you?
Oh, sure. Definitely there's stuff that surprises me frequently and you need to go with it. But I will say the singular moment for me was an interview that was completely about something else. And I asked a question. Actually, no, there were two. Let's start with the sort of more well-known one. Okay. Talking to Bobby Brown, and I mentioned just in passing something about dancing, and completely unprompted, he goes into a story about how he taught Michael Jackson the moonwalk. And I didn't ask about Michael Jackson. I didn't ask about the moonwalk. I mentioned something sort of very broad about dancing.
Yeah.
So whether you believe that or not, I think Bobby Brown believes it. But whether you believe that or not is, I'll leave that to the listener. But that definitely surprised me completely. I think also there was one more, I believe, that I was talking to an artist about something. They mentioned the 1991 game, right? The CNY game, where unfortunately, I think 8 or 9 people got killed right here in New York. And I said, oh, you were there. And they went into this very long, horrific story of being there and watching their friends trampled and how they'd lost friends and all this kind of stuff. And it was a complete, just a unforgettable moment to be there and have that kind of come out of left field and really just be this emotional moment.
Wow. And that just goes to show the level of safety and comfort that you provided for the guests on the cipher to be able to go there.
I would hope so. There were combative moments on the show, certainly. I think anyone who's listened to me talk to Johnny Rotten, to John Lydon, will come to that. But one of the things about that show in particular was that you mentioned something about it being, it's still there. It's an archive, right? And that's how I always envisioned it. Even people I talked to 2 or 3 or 4 times, I always thought, oh, this might be my only chance to talk to them. So let's get everything, right? I wanted it to be about the work and not about gossip or salacious stuff or whatever. Yeah. So things that might lead to more combative situations didn't come up because I specifically wanted this show in large part to be about the person's work, whatever that work was.
But even as much as you avoided that, like even take the Bobby Brown example, doesn't seem like your journalistic integrity will let you have someone just openly provide misinformation. And the way that it was edited for the Bobby Brown podcast in particular was hilarious to me because there was just this long interjection from, who is it, Josh that did
Josh,
that?
Yeah. So shout out to Josh Cross, the producer of the show and kind of the other half of it. He really, that one was really his baby. He really waiting this whole history of Jeffrey from Shalimar and this one and that one, and trying as best as you could to pin down the roots of this dance move and how it got to Michael Jackson.
But then it returns to you and you're just going, oh, really? Okay.
It caught me off guard and it was tangential to the interview. I was so taken aback that I didn't necessarily want to be like, where's your proof? It's an anecdote he told about he was dancing and he showed him this. We tried our best, like you mentioned in the edit, to give as much context as we could. That story actually ended up getting picked up all over the place. So I think TMZ got on it and the tabloids, and his Michael Jackson's family eventually responded in some form and all this stuff. It was like really one of the first times that I had been caught in the aggregation machine that now has overtaken all of us.
You mentioned that you would approach these interviews as though it might be the only time you ever got to speak to these people.
Mm-hmm.
Who are some of the guests that you never got a chance to bring on who, whether it was just timing or maybe they've since passed?
Sure. There are people in all of those categories. I would say foremost among people who I really wanted and circled around and emailed assistants and had reached out to college friends and all this stuff is Chuck D. Because of how important he was to my own artistic and political awakening as a kid. You know, I was lucky enough to speak to Keith Shockley, to Bill Stepney, to other people in that orbit, but never, unfortunately, to him. Although, you know, Chuck, if you're listening, we would bring the show back for you.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Imagine.
Doom. Obviously, Josh is as am I, but Josh is a giant Doom fan. And we had, I think, sent out some emails to people and whatever. Shock G, also someone we pursued. Unfortunately, that didn't pan out. And now will never happen. I think Humpty Dance came out when I was, to date myself, I think in seventh grade.
Oh.
And just how as a middle schooler do you not love that?
Yeah.
And so that Sex Packets album and the EP that followed it and all that stuff was big to me in terms of saying how expansive and fun this music could be, and just that they had a whole concept behind it, however silly and ridiculous the concept was, like, that was immense. So Shock G was up there as well.
And just as we're recording this just a few days ago, we lost Mr. C. Is that somebody who's ever crossed paths with you, or what's your experience with him?
No, I was a giant fan of his. His Biggie mixtape in particular is something that obviously has gotten plenty of burn and that played a huge part in turning me on to the lesser known aspects of his catalog, the Pepsi commercial and the West Coast freestyles and all of the early guest appearances and all of that other stuff that I may have flew by at the time. But no, I don't recall ever meeting him, although it certainly is possible that at one point or another we had been in the same room. But no, unfortunately, I never met him. There are so many important people to talk to that I think the 250 or so episodes we did barely scratched the surface.
It was pretty stunning to me how much ground you covered, and yet knowing that there were still so many names that I didn't see that I would have probably anticipated seeing, but who has the time?
Right.
So you have this vault of the cipher. You have so much journalism out there surrounding hip hop. Do you willingly partake in hip hop debates, or do you prefer to be a fly on the wall?
I would say that I'll jump in occasionally, but I feel like I'm more suited to listening and taking stuff in. I feel like when people ask, who's your top five or whatever, I'll inevitably freeze up and give three core answers and then pause and stutter and immediately regret it and whatever. I feel more comfortable in a situation where I'm just listening and hearing people's takes and slowly forming opinions and things like that.
Does your top five change depending on who you're talking to or time of day, or is it pretty solid?
I would say it shifts depending on my mood. I would say there are a few core people, but yeah, it definitely depends on how much time I have to get it together,
right,
or the mood or what I've been listening to lately or whatever.
I guess a better question is, what is the criteria that you go through in your mind? Because I know you mentioned on the Dad Bod podcast about that controversial article that you did about the best producer alive according to the year. And it wasn't really well known to many ongoers that there was such strict criteria. So in your own mind, for your own top five, what are some of the things that you look for?
In some ways, it's not easy to quantify because it's a lot of who is surprising to me, right? who says stuff that makes me go, wait, they said that? I'd need to rewind it, right? The kind of Black Thought-esque moments where they're like, how did they think of that? How did they rhyme this with that or combine these two ideas or whatever? In addition to, of course, rap is music, right? So there's the sort of rhythmic aspects of it and those kinds of choices and things like that. So it's hard to quantify what exactly makes me say, oh my God, did you hear that? But it's a sort of know it when you see it sort of thing.
I love that. You not only write for Hip Hop DX and you've written for Complex and you're really immersed in the hip hop scene, but then you're also able to switch gears and write for the Sondheim Review.
It is true that I did that. That was one piece. I still have that in my bio. As you pointed out, there's a lot to people, right? So obsessions can be myriad. So I guess that's the point of including it, is that it's funny and unexpected and true. And also legitimately, I think he was a genius. And as I'm here with you, you guys can't see it because it's actually in back of the camera, but I have a big sign with his three key rules for writing that I have right in front of me as I write. So...
oh my gosh, you've got to send me a picture of that.
I will.
Yeah, definitely. I will include it on the website. That's incredible. I respect it so much because, first of all, I relate. I grew up in a family of jazz musicians, but my mom was a Broadway head, but my friends were all listening to hip hop and Michael Jackson. And so just anybody that's that eclectic so broadly is instantly one of my people. But what does it take for you to switch gears in your mindset? Is it all a common thread, or... does it really take a lot for you to do a whole other grounding exercise before you go into writing something outside of hip hop?
That's a good question. And I will say that to take the Sondheim example, right? There was a piece that I begged Grammy.com to let me write, and they eventually did, that was like a listening guide of all of the recordings of his songs in whatever form. Here's whatever, the two or three top recommendations in a number of different categories. And so to prepare for that, it was just like I immersed myself in that world, right? Re-listened to a bunch of stuff, things that I should be up on but hadn't gotten to, whatever. So it's just a matter of living in that world for a while and then having something come out. Likewise, I think that's true of reported music business pieces as well. If you do half a dozen interviews and take 20 pages of notes or something, it takes really getting into the headspace and really concentrating on the thing for something to come out. So I'd say it's a matter of immersion in the particular milieu that you're dealing with. And I don't find it difficult to go from immersion in one thing to immersion in a completely different thing. I think anyone who's had a staff writer job knows what that is, right? You get the assignment to write about something, and then a week later, you're writing about something completely different. So I think that's just sort of part of the gig.
I feel like I would be... although it might have been a fit if Lin-Manuel had gotten his hands on it of DMX being in Company or something. Like, it's right. Speaking of being immersed in something, you wrote this book about, there we go, pointing it out, about Tekashi's story. And you were actually in the courtroom while it was all going down. Was there any sense of grief once the entire process was over? Because you had to, that was like day to day you were there.
The thing about court cases is they never really end. What I mean by that is there's so many, to take the Tekashi case as an example, right? A bunch of arrests happen. There's an arraignment. There are a million hearings leading up to the trial. The trial happens. Tekashi testifies. He wasn't on trial. He was testifying. But that's not it, because then some weeks pass and the people who are on trial get sentenced, and then some more weeks pass and Tekashi, does he go free or have to serve a sentence? And there's a hearing about that. Then the guys appeal, the other one appeals, then there's sentence. There's just stuff that is still drabbling. And if I was still reporting on that case, there probably are still people, the two or three people involved who are serving significant prison sentences. The last time I checked, several of them were in the process of appealing in some way or another. So there's never a hard end. You have to make your own end is what I guess I would say to that.
And you had to decide that for yourself.
Yeah, ultimately, yes. The podcast that I did on it, Infamous, had to be put out. Spotify was paying, Complex was paying. It's got to go up sometime. The book, Dummy Boy, had to be published at some point. There needed to be an end. Sure. I think even as I was writing, Dummy Boy stuff was coming out that worked its way into the book at the very possible last minute. So not about Takashi, but secondary or tertiary characters. Stuff was coming out in court documents up to the last possible minute that was relevant to the book.
Now, Takashi, you've said that you were able to appreciate his earlier music. I'm someone when I listened to this book, Sean, I had to disassociate completely because
sure.
Not just from a moral perspective of what he was up to that entire time, but just I, for better or for worse, might fall into the hip hop purist category.
Mm-hmm.
What are hip hop purists missing out on by remaining in the box that we tend to fit ourselves in?
Look, that's where I may well have considered myself prior to engaging on this. And it's not like I listened to 85 artists in the style of Takashi, but because I was in that world for so long, learned, I think there were a couple things that grabbed me initially, and it was largely just a matter of energy, right? Of the screaming and the sort of delivery and the excitement. It blew up in part because of his image, and I think in part because there was a freshness and a catchiness to a couple of, not his early songs, but the ones that sort of first blew up when he landed on this sort of I'm a blood or am I image, right, that initially got him this sort of hyper fame.
As hip hop progresses into something where we're seeing more and more of artists like him, are we, as the hip hop purists, going to be left behind, or is there some type of through line? Because I know that many of us are like, we're hip hop purists, but we've grabbed onto Kendrick and we've grabbed onto J. Cole and we're just riding that into the sunset, when I feel like, at least for myself, so many of us want to just see a return back to a tremendous amount of care around lyricism and for the culture that we sometimes feel like is being dismissed by a lot of the newer artists.
I think that stuff lives everywhere. Newer artists and veteran artists and whatever. Like, it's, there are hundreds, thousands of rappers making interesting, creative music, and maybe you have to look a little harder for them, etc. But that doesn't mean they are not there. If the most obviously commercial stuff is not to your liking, there is stuff that is, right? That is maybe closer to what you might like or different or whatever. I think there are always things out there. And also, it's a big world and you like what you like, right? That's the other half of it, is that it's not a moral duty to find everything in the world that is new that might appeal to you.
What is it about someone's story that makes it compelling enough to share?
For this one, while it was going on, it's almost like what I was talking about with the top five, right? Where it was like the, can you believe that moment? And this story was full of them. What he just, like, in the middle of the afternoon in Times Square, he just has his friends commit an armed robbery and films it and then sends it to someone who puts it on the internet. Like, why would you possibly do that? Or any of the thousand moments of his guys let off a gunshot in the Barclays Center, and then right outside the Barclays Center, while you can still see it in the background, he goes on the internet and brags about it. All of this stuff, it's unbelievable moments that make you want to tell people, no, he did this and did this. So that's one aspect. The other with him is there's a couple central mysteries at it. And one of which is there was the sort of pseudo manager guy, Shoddy, who was at the center of the story. If those who've read the book, this was the Nine Trey Blood member who served as protector, surrogate father, fake manager, whatever, during Takashi's rise. And depending on who you ask, they were either legitimate friends who had a lot of love for each other, or Takashi was just using this guy, or this guy was extorting. And which one or combination of these things is it, right? And mm-hmm. Depends on who you ask and from what angle you look, or maybe there is one definitive answer. So trying to get to the heart of that also drove a lot of my fascination with this. And in this case, it overlapped with a lot of things that really were central to the world 2017, 2018, 2019, like the rise of social media and even the rise of Trump, right? I think this sort of like idea of I'm just going to antagonize my opponents to no end, and that's going to be how I get attention, and that's how I'm going to become famous. That was the milieu of the whole world back then. It's dealing with a story of a guy who got famous by doing that. And to this day, I think still can't turn that off. That also, I think, kept me in it.
You did an incredible job of writing it without seeming like you were condoning any of it, or even just, it was just reading.
It's a tough situation, right?
Because it is.
You are writing about someone and you don't want everyone reading your book to be like, oh, that guy's irredeemably awful, because why then would you spend so many hundreds of pages on him?
Exactly.
At the same time, I think he did some things that are unforgivable that I talk about in some detail in the book and try to mention in interviews. He has admitted to domestic abuse, and there was the case that I go into in detail in the book involving an underage girl when he was 18, that he was filming her and all of this kind of stuff that is gone into detail in the books. That was always a difficult balance of two. Of, it's fun, it's colorful, crazy stuff happens. And also at root, there's less well-known aspects of it that you don't want people to forget because they caused real harm.
While we're here, because I don't want to blindside you or anything, but are you okay if we go a little deeper into this topic of the domestic violence and things like that?
Sure. Sure.
I think one of the reasons why it was so hard for me to get through the book was because I know Sarah, not personally, but I know her, and I know so many women like her. And for anyone who hasn't read the book yet or familiar, but Sarah was his girlfriend and the mother of his child. And she was the one that made the reports on domestic violence with him. My first question for you is, do you happen to remember when we spoke on the phone years ago?
No, actually. Please remind me.
Yeah.
And so, I apologize.
No, don't worry about it. So in 2015, I had written an article. This was right before the Me Too movement really blew up. I had written an article on Medium called "I Was Raped by a Celebrity and I Didn't Tell Anyone" or something like that. And people found out it was a rapper. Someone put me in touch with you because I believe you and either Josh or you at Complex were doing a story that you wanted to highlight women's stories around hip hop, because at that time, Harvey Weinstein was starting to be pursued. And so you and I spoke, and it must have been with Complex, because I believe the final answer was, "I'm so sorry, Shay, but unfortunately, Complex just doesn't think that the rapper who assaulted you is relevant enough to write this story." And that crushed me. And like, so much credit to you, because you handled every step of it with so much care. And there were several different outlets that I was speaking to at the time that were like, "Oh, just tell us who it is. Tell us who it is." And I was like, I don't have enough means for financial backing to defend myself against this person. And so you were very like memorably careful in the way that you handled it. But always makes me wonder, what is it like for the Sarahs of the world who now have to live every day knowing that their perpetrator is still out there? They're not necessarily saying that you're celebrating him with this book, which you're not, but just that there are books out there and there are things out there to be reminders.
Sure.
And I was reading Elizabeth Mendez Berry wrote this incredible article called "Love Hurts" at Vibe. And
I remember, Elizabeth is someone I know and respect tremendously, of course. I know that's the piece about Liza Rios, right?
Yeah, Big Pun's wife. And so it makes me wonder, at what point do we get our stories told to a point that will at least give us a leg up?
Sure. That is a great question. And I am sorry that the story back then didn't work out. I'm glad that I handled it in a way that you felt okay about.
Thank you.
Yeah. I remember a lot of stuff around then about trying to find stories like that and the difficulties of it. And part of that is, like you said, audience. Part of it is newsroom infrastructure. There are a lot of issues around all of this. I will say, as far as the Tekashi story, I reached out to Sarah's representatives, as you might imagine, trying to get her to speak, and that didn't work. She does tell her story in Vikram Gandhi's documentary. You can definitely hear her in that. And there was, I believe, a Daily Beast piece also where she went into detail about some of the stuff that Tekashi more or less actually later confirms about one particular overseas trip and some violence that she alleges that he later confirmed happened there. So as far as Sarah goes, she has said some stuff. She has said what happened to her in some ways already. But you are absolutely right that there are moral quandaries that come with writing a book like this, that I may want to say I am not glorifying this guy. But as you can see, there's a cartoon face of him on the cover of my book, right? I would be lying if I said I had all of the answers to this and that I feel completely confident that I've balanced everything perfectly in every aspect of reporting on him in this book, in the podcast, in the articles, in all of that. But I hear you. I will say that I hope that the media does get the stories of not just the abusers or alleged abusers, but of their victims out there as well. That definitely started to happen in a major way around when we first talked, around when the Me Too movement was blowing up. It has not happened, I think, nearly enough in any field, and in particular, I think, in the music world. I hope that there is a major reckoning coming of the present and the past. But it's tough because reporting on this is very tough, and there are all sorts of barriers, and people, women or other victims who come out in the open, have an extremely difficult time, right? Putting themselves out in public, subjecting themselves to all sorts of, oh, they're just in it for the money or whatever sorts of ridicule that may come their way. I don't know. These are all very difficult, thorny things. And like, yes, I can say I thought a lot about not wanting to glorify this guy. And where I came down was just trying to tell the story as best as I could and as accurately as I could. Some people may think I shouldn't have done it all or should have done it with a different emphasis. Great. I am not going to stand up and say I am unworthy of criticism. I think I handled it the best way I thought how, and I'm willing to definitely sit here and hear, maybe there are other ways you should have done it. These are all discussions I've had with myself, in my house, with my friends, whatever.
I think you did an exceptionally great job at writing the book, again, very impartially. And it's definitely a systemic thing that is happening with no one's wanting to hear our stories, at least it feels like, right, until it's trending on Twitter.
Right.
They don't want to reach out to you to find out what was your story like. And in the same way in the film industry, in the music industry, it's like it sometimes it just feels if I held my listenership accountable to everyone who I know has committed harm against women, I wouldn't have anything to listen to. I wouldn't have anything to watch. That's how it feels so often.
Sure.
Even reading Elizabeth's article made me feel that way because I was like, oh my gosh, some of these people I love, I spit their bars every now and then when I'm in the shower. Like it's so hard to grapple with. Oh, wait a second. I was one of those women. And every time I thought to step forward, I held myself back. There are so many consequences that come to stepping forward and sharing your story that I think we're not making it any easier on the media coverage that does want to come our way. But yeah, I do, like you said, I really do hope there's a reckoning that comes with that.
Yeah, definitely. And you raised some very tough points about the sort of, to put it in cliche terms, the separation between art and artist. I don't think that there is a particular objective right answer for that. I think it is very personal, right? How you react to that, knowing what you know about whichever artist and how you choose to interact with the work because of that. I think there are, I don't know. I just don't think there's an objectively morally right way to handle it, except perhaps in extreme cases.
You know,
I can, you know, safely say if you're on a sort of super predator level, I think it's fine to say people should not listen to X or Y or play X or Y in public.
Yeah.
But it can get very thorny very quickly.
Absolutely. Thank you for letting me go there with you.
Sure.
Let's pick it up to something happier here. So one of my friends who was actually on the Cypher has recently released a documentary on Paramount, formerly known as YC the Cynic. He's now Kemba.
Kemba, of course.
How does it feel to fully watch like the growth of someone who you knew way back when?
Seeing Kemba's growth has been amazing. I didn't even really know about the movie until it was almost done. And a mutual friend of ours told me that he had been working on this thing. And it's just great. I really loved his work even way back at the comparative beginning of his career. The stuff he released as Kemba was amazing. I saw him get a high-powered manager in the music world. And have some success there. And I remember he came into Complex to play some new music, and I actually had nothing to do with that. And I was just like, that's amazing. I'm so happy he's here. And then to see him move into filmmaking, he's just incredible. And to see that he's remained the same person, right? He's remained thoughtful and committed politically, and still the guy who was like hanging out with Rebel Diaz as a kid, right? He very much has stayed in that world.
I thought it was so interesting that the documentary actually is covering a subject that I believe I've heard you speak on, working on a book maybe.
So there is a manuscript about that is publishers hit me up or whatever. It's done, but not out in the world. Maybe it will be someday. There was also, unfortunately, a larger project that I had begun on the relationship between rap and policing that unfortunately, due to the turmoil of the media world, never went anywhere. But I have written about it. I wrote about it for Complex a bunch, and it's something that continues to fascinate me, and that I'm very interested in. And both the history of it, going back to Derek Parker and his time at the NYPD, and all the way to today. Seeing a couple of these trials close up of rappers was interesting on that level, right? The way that music played out in Pop Smoke's case, in Tekashi's case, to a lesser extent, but still somewhat in Melly's case, right? YW Melly in Florida, both in the actual legal proceedings and in the public perception of that, was interesting. And I think that's a subject ripe for many documentaries and books and all the rest of it. I've also been happy to see this related issue of lyrics in court, which Kemba's documentary deals with, become so talked about, especially with the YSL case. I have been in courtrooms where judges were trying to make those decisions about which lyrics in a song should be admissible, right? Down to the line, right? Down to the lyric. And I've seen judgments that I thought were fair and judgments that I thought were over the top. And also, I can definitely understand and respect the positions of a lot of people. And on many days, I hold this position myself where lyrics shouldn't be admissible at all, even if they are germane, even if they are relevant to the case. Get other evidence. I think that's the position that at least some people hold. And like I said, on a lot of days, I'm there myself.
No, I completely agree. We're wrapping up here. I do want to ask you, your mentor, Bill Adler, correct me if I'm wrong, he's a journalist that eventually became director of publicity at Def Jam.
That's right. He started out as a journalist for sure.
So do you ever see yourself embarking on a different career path, or is this the lane that was meant for you?
I feel comfortable where I am. I feel like having a relationship to the commercial music business that is inquisitive, at times adversarial, a little bit on the outside, fits me better than if I were fully in a place where my goal was to help sell stuff. That said, it's a big world. Media is in crisis. Anything can happen. And obviously, I tremendously admire Bill. And I think Bill and people in his milieu in the 80s are the reason that I was even aware of rap as a grammar school kid in suburban New Jersey, right? So there is certainly good work to be done in that world. So probably not, but I don't know, I guess, is where I would land.
All right, we'll keep the options open. I can't even believe that I forgot to touch on the fact that you're from Jersey. I'm from Jersey.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But you're from so I'm from North Jersey.
Different Jerseyan, world. Different world. Yeah.
I know. You're from a place that some Jerseyans might argue doesn't exist.
Oh, Central Jersey, of course. Yes. 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 No, so, dead center for sure.
So everyone, he's here. I can see him. Central Jersey might actually, in fact, exist. This is the proof.
More New York than Philadelphia. I think that was just an artifact of the community I grew up in. That was where everyone, all the adults worked.
Now, okay, before I completely let you go, the reason why I initially had brought you on the show to begin with was because I wanted to give people an understanding of how, because every artist that I talk to is like, oh, I would love to just end up in Complex and things like that. How? Is that even feasible? And when is it feasible?
Great question. What I would say about that is, from my years at Complex, is if you're there long enough, you get an idea of when an artist is in the world of artists who the audience might care about. So it's like someone is in there, not to sound mystical about it, but it's almost like when they're ready to be there, right? Then the outlet will come calling. I think pitching certainly helps, but it's also if you are on that track of being in the kind of music that outlet covers, they'll know about you. That said, if there is a writer who is a giant fan, that can go a long way. I definitely remember my colleague at the time, Kiana Fitzgerald, was a giant Megan Thee Stallion fan long before she blew up and pushed and pushed and pushed and finally got Meg in Complex. This wow. was before her mom died, because I remember her mom came to the office with her.
Oh.
And so definitely it can happen if someone there is passionate about your music. And also it just mostly depends of the sort of ever-shifting hierarchy you happen to fall into it based on these indefinable criteria.
Okay, there you have it, everyone.
That's not so specific as email Bob or whatever, but right.
But it's important. I've advised people that you should pay attention to the not as widely known magazines as Complex and get yourself placed there, because that's how you're going to rise to the top eventually. So it sounds like that's pretty much on par with what you're saying.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing of whatever the cliche is about you see a person's name X number of places before you remember it or whatever.
Right.
It's like that. If you're getting coverage in the sort of discovery places, eventually that will bubble up to the larger outlets.
Right. Sean, thank you so much for spending this time with me today. I'm so tickled that you were able to come on and share your expertise with us and really delve into some vulnerable topics. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Shay. And thank you again for that incredible tribute. Like, I just mind blowing that you put that together.
Of course. Everyone, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please make sure you're subscribed, share it with a friend. We want to help as many independent musicians out there as possible. And we will see you next week.
Sean Sitaro. Met Sean Sitaro back in his rap genius days. Remember that? Sean is a wonderful journalist, music journalist in the tradition of the old guard of music journalism. Just really dope reporter, really good interviewer, very comfortable interviewing style. And he gets the goods. You got to check out the cipher, because it's a lot of good work that was done over there. He blew us up with the Grape Gate. Shout out to Grape Gate. Shout out to Coco and the entire crew. And really just a good guy. Sean is just a great guy. And he never once got annoyed when I'd hit him constantly for all the tea about 6ix9ine during the trial. Yeah, Sean is amazing. And this is Mila. Love you, Sean. Signing off.
Check 1, 2. This is Jay Smooth of the Underground Railroad, Ill Doctrine, and so forth. Giving a special shout out to Mr. Sean Sitaro, a diligent, thorough student and documenter of the culture. Also an accomplished musician. I don't know how many people know that. And a good friend in real life. So this is redundant, but I want to let the world know, unless they don't know, Sean Sitaro is a real one. And I hope to see you soon, brother.
Sean Sitaro. An amazing interviewer, someone who contributes to the culture by documenting it with great insight and care. I am not an easy interview, but when I came on the Cypher, we had an amazing conversation that was both challenging and inspiring. And so shout out to you, Sean Sitaro, because you are super, super dope. Journalist, podcaster, ally. All the things, and you are appreciated. This is Tembisa, and I'm out.
Ayo, Sean Sitaro. Just want to give you your flowers, your well-deserved flowers, my brother. You know what I mean? Dope editor, dope writer, journalist, all of that, man. Just a dope contributor to the culture. We truly appreciate you. You know, I remember meeting him for the first time, early days when he was with Rap Genius, and they made an appearance on the Combat Jack Show. We've been rocking ever since. So just want to salute to you. Keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate you. One love. A. King, signing out.
In all of my greatest memories of New York, Sean is a person who showed up. If there was an event, if there was a celebration, if there was a conversation to be had, Sean shows up. That is what I remember the most about my time in the music industry at the time that I was most active
was not always the most friendly place, particularly not for a woman or a Black woman. But Sean showed up. That's evident in the work he does and in the relationships he has. And I'm really grateful to count him among the people who I was able to look to as a mentor in this industry.
Peace and love, y'all. It's your man, Manny Faces, creator and host of the Hip Hop Can Save America podcast and live stream show, and an award-winning journalist myself, I might add. I've crossed paths with Sean on several occasions over the last, decade or two, which is crazy, in my beat as a journalist covering New York area hip hop music and culture. I think Sean has a great way of taking sort of the pop music, front-facing celebrity stuff that happens in hip hop music and culture and writes about it in a way that gives it some depth. It's not just clickbait. It's not just gossipy stuff that's going to take off and then flail out. There's some depth to the stuff that he covers, because a lot of hip-hop journalism focuses on the more salacious, sensational parts of it. Sean usually gets to the thing right behind the thing. And that's what I enjoy about it. I think that all hip-hop music and culture journalism should respect the genre, should respect the culture, should respect the people who have built this thing we do. And Sean's always come across as someone that has those intentions in mind. And I know it's difficult to be a journalist in today's world, especially an entertainment journalist, but I've always appreciated Sean's work of going beyond the surface of a lot of these stories and quirky things. And of course, what he's probably best known for, a look at what a lot of purists and traditionalists in hip hop might have deemed unworthy of such detailed, in-depth coverage. But again, I think all coverage is worthy as long as the coverage is worthy. So I thank Sean for always seeming to have those ideals when it comes to covering hip hop music and culture.
Yo, this is Tony Blackman, first U.S. hip hop ambassador. I want to salute Sean Sitaro for his contribution, his commitment, his dedication. I am a big fan of music journalism and real hip hop journalism. As big a fan as I am of the music itself, as a practitioner, as a lover of the culture, Rap Genius and the Cypher podcast sealed the deal for me. Sean is consistent and in the spirit and the memory of the late, great Greg Tate. I think it's important to give him his flowers and to salute and to say thank you, because these cats are keepers of the culture and history, and they play an important role in the circle of our creative lives. So give this man his flowers, yo.
Hey, what's up? Mr. Lin here. Giving my flowers to Sean Sitaro. What's going on, my man? Definitely one of my better sit-downs interviewers that I've sat with. Sean, I really love his respect for the culture. So many people just use this thing as a job. And for Sean, you can tell it's an actual passion. And for me, that's a lot, because as artists, you don't get a lot of money. The least you can get is some passion. But even more than that, as a journalist, I always liked that it was never a salacious hunt. It was always facts and accuracy. And for me, that makes it easier to sit down and talk, because I'm not somebody that's going to be all about the sensationalism and the ridiculousness of what we do. Like I said, for him to have that respect for the culture and then really stick to his guns as a journalist and be about facts and accuracy, that always worked for me. Respect to my man, Sean Sitaro.
Yeah, I'm sending this one out to the brother Sean. He really should just go by one name, like Iman or Bowie or something like that. As you look at him, it's all mild-mannered, friendly, and happy, but that's the Clark Kent. That's only Clark Kent. You fall for it. Everybody falls for the Clark. But the second he gets behind the pen and those glasses come off, he is Superman. A Tekashi killing Superman. And how can you not be afraid of a guy like that? Because those glasses can come off at any second. Yo. One time for the boy Sean. I'm staying on this good side. That's all I got to say about one. Oh, it's Mecca, by the way. Salute, bro. 100.